Welcome to ECE 498AL. This course is titled Programming Massively Parallel Processors, and we are in Lecture 1, Introduction. First of all, I'd like to make sure that we all are clear about the goals of this course. This course, the primary purpose of the course is to teach how to program massively parallel processors for high performance. If you are not interested in high performance, then this course will be a waste of your time. And in fact, one of my friends have said that very nicely, unless you care about high performance, parallel programming is extremely easy. So this course is really designed for those of you who want to learn parallel programming for high performance. And also very important is that as we teach the skills for achieving high performance in parallel computing, we also want to make sure that we teach you how to maintain the kind of functionalities or the maintainability of your code while you parallelize your code. And another important consideration is that your parallel program will have to be scalable across multiple future generations of processors. And unless the program is scalable, its value will diminish as time progresses. So, we're going to teach the skills that are needed to achieve those goals, and in particular, it will be the principles and patterns of parallel programming, and we're going to teach a lot of these basic skills and principles. But when it comes to the practical use of parallel programming, the patterns from various application domains will be very important, in attacking the harder problems. And the processor architecture features and constraints. When we first taught this course, we actually spent a lot of time at the beginning to teach architectural features and constraints. But as you will see, one of the major changes we're making in the semester is to go right into programming, and then we come back and teach the processor architecture features and constraints just in time to enable performance tuning. And we're also going to make changes so that the material architecture features and so on will be more self-contained and more user-friendly for students, for those of you who are not from computer science or electrical and computer engineering departments. And we're also going to spend quite a bit of effort talking about programming APIs, meaning application programming interfaces, and tools and the techniques. So on slide three, I'm going to be the one of the primary instructors for this course, and my office is at 215 CSL, and then I have my email address on the slide. And for those of you who are interested in, who would be sending me email, please make sure that you have ECE498AL to start your email subject line. And I receive hundreds of emails every day, and I would like to respond as quickly as I can. And by using that keyword to start the subject line, it would allow me to sort my emails and catch your emails more quickly. My office hours are going to be 2 o'clock to 3:30 on Wednesdays. So you can either call me or you can come to my office hour, and I would be glad to discuss any topic of interest to you. And you can come and introduce yourself. You can come and talk about what particular aspects of the course that you would like to see more emphasis. And so just come by and talk to me. My co-instructor is David Kirk, and he's the chief scientist of NVIDIA, and he's also a professor of the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department of the University of Illinois. And David and I have been working together on the various versions of this course, and we have been co-teaching this, this course and its variations through the past 2 years. And we are, in many ways, truly partners in crime, and we work very closely on all the course materials. The teaching assistant this semester is going to be John Stratton, and he is actually a volunteer TA. With all the budget limitations and constraints, we decided to chip in and reduce the burden, financial burden from on the ECE department. So John is going to be present in all the lectures, and he's going to answer a lot of the detailed technical questions regarding the tools and the programming interfaces and so on. John has been spending time at NVIDIA to make sure that he has up-to-date knowledge, and he and I will complement each other on a lot of the materials through the lectures. And you will see that in a lot of the more detailed subject, I'm going to cue John to give some supplementary material or to add his comments and insights. And I'm also going to have several of my senior grad students who have taken this course to help with the grading and to help with some of the project as we go into the semester. Slide four. One of the important, very important pieces of information for this course is the web resources. And the website is courses.ece.uiuc.edu/ece498/al. And this website has all the handouts and lecture slides and recordings, as well as the textbook chapters. This is one of the changes that were positive changes that we're making this semester. After teaching this course several times, David and I are co-authoring a textbook for the course, and the chapters are going to be deposited into the class website. And a few weeks ago, I sent out a mass email to all the registered students and refer you to the Great Lake Consortium Summer School website, where we have the first four textbook chapters posted. And you should have read some of these chapters. So we will be moving much of the material and all the new all the textbook chapters and so on into the course website this week. Also, while we make an effort to make announcement on the websites, we really cannot guarantee that we have everything on the website. So do not use this website to replace the class material. So make sure that you catch all the announcements and in the lectures. So for those of you who might need to miss some of the lectures, make sure that you listen to the lecture recording while you are away. And another important forum that you're going to be spending time on is the web board. And the web board is accessible through the class website, and it's a very good forum for two things. One is we're going to be making electronic announcements, so you should tune in to the various announcements for the course. And the second one is really for the class to discuss with each other on the projects, on the MPs. So John and I will be monitoring the web board, but our experience is that most of the questions will be answered by you. And by asking and answering questions, you will definitely get a lot more out of the course than otherwise. We will be using Compass for grading purposes. Slide five, we're grading shows the grading system for the course. And keep in mind that this is a lab-oriented course, so we're placing a lot of emphasis on the actual lab assignments and the projects. And we have 20% of the grade attributed to exam, and 30% attributed to the structured lab assignments, and then half of the grades will come from the final project. The final project would be probably the most rewarding experience that you will be getting out of the course. You will be able to to define your final project if you like. But if you don't want to define your own final project, and you can, we are going to have some world-class application teams to define and mentor some of the final projects. In either case, you should be able to get a lot of reward out of the final projects. Slide six. One of the features of this class is that we're going to place a lot of trust and a lot of expectations on you as a mature student. So if you get sick, if you get you need to go and interview for a summer position or you're not going to get. A permission from me or the TAs or get doctor's notes. So basically every one of you will get five what we call the bonus days, and each bonus day is a no question ask 1 day extension that can be used on most assignments. And one of the limitations of bonus days is that if you have a multi-member a project team, in order to get 1 day of extension, you're going to actually have to get one bonus day from each member of your team and combine all the bonus days into 1 day for the whole team. So this is something that you're going to the reason why we mentioned this is when you form the team, you may want to do some credit check and make sure that your prospective team members actually all have some bonus days left, so that you can you don't run into a bad situation where one of your team members has already squandered all the bonus days. And you can use multiple bonus days on the same thing and get multiple days of extension. Whenever there's a weekend or holiday, it will not count for the number of days of extension. For example, if you want to move the due date from Friday to Monday, that counts as 1 day extension, and they use up one bonus day. And it's really intended to cover, as I mentioned, illness and interview visits, and if you just need more time. All of us are running into situations where we just need a little more time. So this gives you a little slack. And when you a little bit of mechanics in about using the bonus days, the web page. If you go to the website, you will find a bonus day form. And you can print it out, you can sign and attach the thing you want to turn in. And everyone who's using a bonus day on a team assignment needs to sign the form. So essentially everyone needs to release one of the bonus days for that for that extension. So 1 day. So if you use up all the bonus days, then you will begin to run into penalty for delays in the project. So every extra day beyond bonus days is 10% off of the possible points per day. And after 10 days, naturally there's no reason to turn in the project anymore. And by the way, the spring and fall break will count as weekdays. So there are things that you shouldn't or you cannot use bonus days for. The final project design document and the final project presentations and the final project demo. So the reason why we cannot allow you to use bonus days is because we're running a workshop on the final project. And we need to have your final project design document in order to make the workshop productive and so that we can give you some valuable feedback And same thing with final project presentation. We're going to have a class symposium on one of the days near final. So you know, everyone needs to be present to, you know, to present and to benefit from other projects. So you really shouldn't you know, use bonus day to delay your presentation. And the final project demo is usually scheduled as late as possible in a semester so that you can get the most working time into the project. But that also means that we cannot give you bonus day extensions to, you know, to because we simply don't have room for the maneuvering at in that time frame. Naturally, you cannot use bonus days to delay your exam. For those of you who are taking the course, the next few slides are relevant to you. Otherwise, you should feel free to skip over the next few slides. When I teach this course, I always need to always talk about academic honesty, not because I don't trust you. In fact, I have never had any need to invoke some of these academic honesty rules and in any kind of incident so far. However, the real intention to go over these is because I want to make sure that you understand the parameters around these rules so that you can operate comfortably within the parameters and get the most out of your projects and studies. So the most important message here is that as a class, you're really allowed and encouraged to discuss assignments with other students in the class. And you should feel free to talk about your ideas and then work your ideas into the actual code and actual algorithms. So but getting verbal advice or help from people who have already taken the course is also fine. So if you have a group member in your research group that has already taken the course, you say, hey, I'm thinking about doing MP this way, and am I on the right track, and this is the way I'm thinking about it, great. And this is also how you're going to operate in research groups and in industry in the future. However, you should not go and look at the assignments from previous terms or the from the web postings and try to get information and for your own project or your own assignment. And this is to make sure that you truly have thought through your own project and putting your work into the project. And any copy of code in this course is unacceptable. And essentially, if you copy anything like a line or more, then it's unacceptable behavior. This is something that we're going to draw the line that is more strict than the industry. In industry, you may find yourself borrowing code as long as the authors approve. And you can feel free to borrow code, especially in the open source kind of community. However, as a course, we want to make sure that you actually have the opportunity to write all your code and then learn everything that you need to learn out of that out of these assignments. So, the next slide, 9, is about is just a little bit more information on the academic honesty. And naturally, giving or receiving help on an exam is just unacceptable. And so, if we ever catch any of this of you, then the penalty for any kind of violation is going to be zero on the assignment for the first occasion, and then automatic failure of the course for any repeated offenses. And let me say this again, I have never had a need to invoke these penalties. So please keep it that way for me. And I would love to to work with you. I would love to to get the most help each of you to get the most out of this course, and I simply do not want to give out any of these penalties, so do not force me to. So slide 10 gives a little bit more information about what our expectations are in these in the teams. So there will be projects and assignments that you can work in teams, and these works, whenever we have a team project, you can really divide up the work among team members in any way that you that works for all of you. So as long as all of you can agree on the division, you know, it's really up to you. However, at the end of the project, each of you will demo the final checkpoint of each MP and project individually, and you will get a separate demo grade. And this is because we want to make sure that every member has, has learned, to the most out of these projects. And so this will include questions on the entire design. And if you have multiple members, we will not accept a answer like, oh, this is Joe's part, and I'm not quite very familiar with that part. The rationale here is that if you don't, even if you don't directly work on that part, you should be involved enough in the discussions and then in the review of the code for each other that you should be able to answer questions. And if you cannot answer questions on those parts, then you're just not involved enough in the project. So this is something that I want to make sure that you understand right from the beginning. Slide 11. We're going to also enjoy some of the progress this semester on the lab equipment. So depending on the availability of the accounts this week, you may be doing the first project based on your own PCs, desktops or laptops running the GAD emulators. And these emulators are worth learning. And even if you have, we have the class machine accounts ready, you still will need or want to use the emulator just so that you are familiar with the better debugging support and features and so on available from the emulators. And then most of the rest of the semester you will be using real GPU hardware, essentially the G80 generation or the G280 generation boards. And I'm going to go over some details about the class accounts on the QP and AC clusters, and these are x86 CPU boxes with GPUs attached to the CPUs, and so that we can execute the entire application with some parts on the x86 CPUs and some parts on the GPUs. And these real hardware are much faster than the emulators, but they also have much less debugging support. Slide 12 shows the QP cluster that you will be using at the first part in the first part of the semester. There are 16 nodes, and each node has a quad core CPU CPU in it, and it also has four GPU chips, and these are currently the G80 chips. There are two GPU chips per box, and there are two boxes per node, and these boxes are called quadruplex boxes. These GPUs are donated by NVIDIA, and I would like to acknowledge the generous donation that for the benefit of our students. And if you use the QP cluster, each node is capable of delivering 1.16 teraflops, and for the Columbic summation code that John Stone runs on a regular basis, and this is approximately 176 times speed up versus the Intel QX6700 CPU core with SSE. So you know what, each node is a very powerful computing device that you will eventually be using on your application. And if you have advanced enough knowledge about MPI and so on, you can feel free to define your final project so that your application can actually run on all the nodes. And then within each node, you can take advantage of the GPU acceleration. This machine actually has a very large user community. Ever since we installed the machine in May, the QPS cluster has completed 27,000 jobs and 14,000 job hours. So people, there are many real research groups and so using this machine. And we also use this machine for the various courses and summer schools and intensive tutorials and so on worldwide. And I would like to make sure that you understand that this is a very nice resource donated generously donated by NVIDIA and used by many people. So you want to be gentle when you use the resources, and don't launch a massive number of jobs at the same time and bog down the machine. So make sure that you are considerate when you use this resource. And in the next couple months, we are going to be moving into upgrading the QPS cluster into AC cluster. In fact, if you log in today, the QP cluster has already been renamed into AC, and it's just that it's a 16 node with the old QP configuration. And we already received all the G280 GPUs, and we're also doubling the number of nodes in the cluster. So it's going to be a 32 node system with four new generation GTX 280 GPUs from the Tesla line. And we're also going to upgrade the InfiniBand connection, because the computational power within each node has increased so much that we are outstripping the capabilities of the InfiniBand interconnection among these nodes. So that's actually what's going to be the main delay. We just ordered the equipment, so the InfiniBand equipment. So this equipment is going to be arriving in the next few weeks, and we're going to bring up the machine. And the way we're going to bring up the machine is we're going to keep 16 nodes running in the QP configuration, and we'll bring up the other 16 nodes using the new AC configuration. When the operation, when the new AC configuration 16 node system is has been verified, we will make that into the new AC cluster, and we will upgrade the old QP configuration half into the AC, the new second generation configuration. So by doing this, there should be no downtime, and we should be able to just instantly switch from QP to AC 16 and then to AC 32. Once we bring up the new system, you should be able to see quite a bit of performance improvement. For Johnstone's columbic summation code, you will see about 60% to 70% improvement. So rather than 1.17 or so teraflops, each node will be executing at about 1.78, roughly 1.8 teraflops per node. And this is 271 times speed up versus the Intel QX6700 CPU core with SSE. And just a few years ago, in order to get this level of teraflops performance, you will need to really get hold of a very large cluster. And now this is going to be available. And one of you just asked, what are we going to do with the G80 generation GPU boxes. So the answer is very the answer is actually quite simple. You know, some of you will end up using the these boxes. So we will end up with 32 of those Kudroplex boxes, and each Kudroplex box will have two GPU cards in there, and we're going to convert them back into the desktop desk side configuration and make them available to the members of the Institute of Advanced Computing Applications and Technology, IACAT members. And so many of you with PhD advisors of many of you are actually members of the IACAT. So if you have your advisor contact me, you know, chances are you might end up with one of those boxes next to your desk. Okay, so you know, so the slide 14 shows the textbook information and you know, for the course and the reference notes. First of all, we do have a very positive development. This semester, we're going to be to have a the draft textbook by David Kirk and myself available for you to use as the textbook for this course. And this is the first time ever that we actually have a textbook, you know, available textbook, you know, chapters that will that go with all the lectures. And the second one is, you know, we are going to continue to use NVIDIA CUDA programming guide as a reference book. And so this is going to be the 2.0 version. And we will continue to use Tim Matson's and his three other co-authors' book on patterns for parallel programming. And this book is a little bit dated at this point, and I know that Tim Matson is working with Kurt Queser at Berkeley on a new parallel pattern book. So I will try to make that to convince Tim to make some of his new chapters available for you to you. So finally, we will definitely have the lecture notes and recordings posted at the class website. Slide 15 shows the tentative schedule, and for the first part of the semester. As always, there will be adjustments as we go on, and you know, we are making some you know, changes this semester again. To make sure that the course is more user-friendly, and we are also trying to evolve the course in such a way that you know, we can in the future we can have simultaneous you know, offering of this course to many universities with some local professor you know, supervision. So you know, ultimately we would like to make the course available to about 10,000 people per year. So you know, you will definitely see you know, quite a bit of adjustment and so on along the way. There are a couple of things to note on this slide. One is, you know, we're going to have a regular makeup class slot, which is going to be Wednesdays from 5:10 to 6:30. And we're not going to have, you know, a makeup class every week. We are going to just have makeup class whenever I know for sure that I need to make miss some of the original class time due to travels. So, you know, we're going, looking at the tentative schedule, week one, we're, you know, we're just at the introduction lecture, and on Thursday, we're going to be jumping right into the CUDA introduction to CUDA programming model. And this is, you know, this is so that you can begin to work on programming assignments right from week one. And you know, in the lab, you're going to be you know, doing MP0, where you install the you're going to be installing the emulators, and you're going to, you know, run some basic, very simple Hello World kind of program. For week two, we're going to have, you know, continue to talk about the CUDA programming model, and then we're going to be introducing the thread programming, the threading modeling of CUDA. And that in the lab, you're going to be working on simple matrix multiplication and simple vector reduction. So for week three, you're going to be working on CUDA CUDA, you know, a memory model, and we're going to be talking about you know, the various you know, specialized memories, and you know, and so on. That this is actually one of the more most complex aspect of CUDA, and we're also going to be talking about some basic techniques that people use to best utilize the various specialized memories. The most important one being the tiling of memory accesses. So in MP2, you'll be developing a tiled, you know, a matrix multiplication. And in week four, we will be talking about, you know, we'll be introducing some of the hardware features, and then we'll be going into performance tuning. And you are going to have some, you know, for the machine problem, you're going to be working on simple and tiled two-dimensional convolution. So at this point, we are pretty much done with the logistics of the course, and I want to kind of you know, talk a little bit about the history and how this course came about. So in January 06, you know, David Kirk visited University of Illinois, and you know, he gave a guest lecture at my ECE 511, which is the graduate level computer architecture course. And you know, after he gave the lecture, the Dick Blaha, the ECE department head back then, and I, you know, had dinner with David. And you know, David mentioned to us that you know, the industry is moving heavily into parallel computing, and you know, everyone is concerned that the universities are not teaching the students properly, and then the students will not be able to, you know, to develop parallel applications and tools and so on. So you know, he encouraged us to, you know, to teach more of the parallel programming. And then you know, Dick Blaehut, who's a very impressive, you know, individual, turn the table around and say, David, you know, since you have so much incentive to see the to make this a success, why don't you come and teach this course? And you know, so Dave, you know, David said, ha, you know, I would consider this. And you know, basically I said to David, you know, if you come and teach this, I will do this with you, okay? And then, you know, so we left at dinner that day with all these, you know, with that. So you know, a little bit later, a few months later, David visited several campuses including UIUC. And you know, so basically, at you know, after visiting multiple universities, David actually picked the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign to launch this course. But so David and I started to, you know, to work on some of the material, and then we started to plan this course. But everything really started to get in into, you know, high gear when NVIDIA announced G80. And so, you know, in November 06, four of my PhD students, including John Stratton here, sitting here, who's the TA of the course, went to NVIDIA, and then we went through a one-day training program, and this is what they call the kitchen day, and that's where we cook. You know, we cook for, you know, lab assignments and so on. And it's kind of a, you know, it was a kind of a, you know, a little bit of a humiliating experience for me. And you know, that was the day when I started to realize that I'm no longer as quick and as, you know, as effective as my young students. So after the first assignment, I you know, I was a few minutes behind my students, and then after the second assignment, I was 10 minutes behind. After the third assignment, I was almost half an hour behind. And then during the fourth assignment, I got an emergency cell phone call from my office. And then, you know, I never finished the fourth assignment. So, you know, my students, of course, all finished their assignments. They are all smiling. And then, you know, I see the point, right? So, you know, the point that is that by the time you finish this course, you will be a much better CUDA programmer than I am. Okay, and then I'm going to be okay with it. In fact, I'm going to be very proud of it. And so you don't need to tiptoe around me and then hide the fact that you're much better than me as a CUDA programmer, because I'm going to take pride in your success. And So in January 07, we actually, you know, kick off the first offering of this course. And it was, you know, I still remember during Christmas break, David and I were panicking, and we were just trying to generate all the lecture notes and, you know, define all the lectures. And, you know, my wife started to get a little bit suspicious that I was getting these, you know, phone calls in the evenings, and, you know, we'll be talking on the phone for hours. And, you know, and so, you know, eventually, you know, we all, you know, we got it all cleared up. But, you know, I have to admit that, you know, it was a very interesting Christmas break. And so after we started to offer the course in January, it was very interesting in the sense that there, you know, the much of the details of CUDA and GAD were still not in public domain. So we actually had to have the entire class to, you know, to be under NDA, non-disclosure agreement with NVIDIA, so that we can go ahead and teach all the material. And with the, you know, you do what you got to do. And, you know, it was, you know, it was one of those kind of, you know, fun memory that we can go back to. And, you know, we actually did whatever we need to do to, you know, to make this course happen. So in February, you know, NVIDIA releases CUDA, and then we no longer need the NDA. And at that point, we make the website available online. And then that instantly, that website has become one of the most popular access. It actually brought it down to its knees, you know, at some point. But, you know, we're very proud that we were able to, you know, to help the world to learn the material. And in March 07, you know, John Stone and Jim Phillips and, you know, the NAMD groups and many other application groups at UIUC started to report their results, and then started to post some challenging and interesting projects for the for the students taking the course. And then you know what, eventually more than a year later, Illinois became the world's first CUDA Center of Excellence, with emphasis on education and tool to enable widespread CUDA development in the worldwide. So it's kind of a long journey, but it's really a lot of fun. And the material that you're going to be learning are actually have already been through multiple iterations, and many of the previous students helped to refine the material. So, you know, you should also feel feel free to help to refine the material for future students. So any questions for now? If not, let's go into the sort of the technical part of the introduction. So, you know, before we go and learn the CUDA programming model, I kind of wanted to clarify, you know, how the CUDA, how the CUDA systems come about, and why, you know, where does the GPU hardware and the CPU hardware sit in the stand in the kind of the big picture. So you know, the fact that you are going to be able to parallelize some of these applications and into CUDA and get dramatic performance improvement come from the fact that there was a quiet a long period of quiet revolution and potential build-up. So started in about year 2003, the CPU design community ran into some very major challenges in terms of power limitations. So you know, the design of the CPU chips have been have been evolving in the direction of improving single thread application performance. And essentially, people write the code in expecting the code to be executed one instruction after the other, and then the underlying hardware will take these instructions and extract parallels and out of them, and that will involve sophisticated hardware to be able to reorder the execution of instructions, to be able to predict, you know, do branch prediction, and to be able to cache data. So all these capabilities require you know, a lot of hardware support, and all the hardware that support these features consume power. So you know, when I was a grad student in the mid 1980s, I did my PhD thesis on these techniques, and eventually these techniques went into products in the next 15 years or so, and we had a great run. But you know, we all knew going into it that these things will have limited lifetime in terms of progress. So in year 2000 or so, we started to see all kinds of signs of the slowdown in terms of CPU single thread performance improvement. So in the next few years, the CPU performance had a fairly slow improvement in terms of their speed. However, the graphics community was driven by a very different economy and different applications. The graphics community were not really, constrained to execute a large number of applications, but rather they were focusing on graphics applications where pixels are many, many millions of pixels are being generated, on a real-time basis, and which required massive amount of parallelism. And over time, the graphics processors just took more and more parallel approach, and was able to execute in higher and higher floating point performance. So by year 2007, the GPUs are really in every PC and workstation, and they're as massive in value volume and also potential impact. This actually makes it very unique in terms of the parallelism, because before GPUs, the parallel computers are very small in number and only available to the privileged few, but once we enter the GPU world, there are GPUs in essentially every PC and workstation. So by making these GPUs more programmable and play the role of parallel computers, we start to make massive number of massively parallel computers available to the masses. So if you look at the comparison in end of 2006, in the terms of calculation, the GPUs can do 367 gigaflops versus the 32 gigaflops of the CPUs. And the memory bandwidth are multi-core CPUs, and then the memory bandwidth is about 86.4 gigabytes per second versus the 8.4 gigabytes per second for the Intel frontside bus. And until last year, most of the GPUs have been programmed through graphics API, application programming interfaces, but that changed when NVIDIA introduced CUDA. So for the GeForce 8800, if you look at the hardware design, the hardware architecture, it's really a highly threaded, highly threaded computer. And on slide 18, we show the high level organization of the hardware, where the host will be able to request the generation of thousands of threads, and then the thread execution manager would parcel out these threads into the multiple of processor cores on the chip. So there are eight boxes, but each box is also divided into halves, and each half is what we refer to as the streaming multiprocessor. They consist of each of these streaming multiprocessors contain eight small processor cores. Each one is capable of executing floating point add and the floating point multiply at the same time. So we have 8 times 16, which is 128 small processor cores, and these processor cores are all able to execute floating point instructions at a very high pipeline, high rate. So we're going to come back to this, to the some of the organization later. But the point is, there is a massive number of floating point units on these chips, and there's a massive amount of bandwidth available to bring data in and out of these chips for parallel computing. So slide 19 kind of summarizes the GAD characteristics. We already mentioned that it's about 25 to 50 times more powerful than the high-end its contemporary high-end microprocessors, and for the new generation, it maintains a similar level of performance advantage compared to their contemporaries. And for real applications such as VMD, the Columbic potential calculation, we're able to John Stone was able to show that you can sustain 265 gigaflops, and it's massively parallel, 128 cores running at 90 watts, and it's fairly power hungry, but it's not a whole lot more power hungry than the CPU chips, high-end CPU chips. And it's massively threaded. It sustains about thousands and thousands of threads per operation at the same time. And we're going to see this in the next few lectures. And you can actually achieve between 30 about 100 times speed up over high-end microprocessors on scientific and media applications, medical imaging, molecular dynamics, and so on. So I included a quote by from John Stone when he first tested the GAD chip, when we first got the GAD boards on campus, and he tested them, and he said, "Wow, I think they're right on money, but the huge performance differential. Currently, 3 GPUs is as good as 300 SGI Altix Itanium 2s will invite very close scrutiny, so I have to be careful." And I say what I say in publicly until I triple check these numbers. So the point is, the speed up, the amount of parallelism, the speed up is so much that even very experienced programmers were really surprised when they see the actual results. So we expect many of you to have the same reaction after at the end of the semester. And why are we beginning to see more applications that are getting this kind of massive speed up? The reason is more and more of the future applications are actually reflecting a the concurrent real world. Now in the real world, the phenomenon is all concurrent, and the motion of air particles, the motion of people, and so on, are all very parallel, and there's very little dependence, sequentiality in these natural phenomena. And a lot of the applications in the future will be used to reflect or to manipulate phenomena in this kind of real world. So we are going to see applications such as molecular dynamics, video processing, and three-dimensional imaging and visualization, and consumer game physics, and all these are very exciting applications that would essentially be calculating phenomena that reflect this concurrent physical world. And you may say, hey, how about this molecular dynamics simulation? And isn't that only used by a few scientists in the world? And I say no, because with the capability of molecular dynamics coming into the GPUs and so on, and undergraduate physics students and undergraduate engineering students studying physics cannot just use the molecular dynamics simulation to study a lot of the physics and chemistry and so on that we're going to have, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of science class students who will be, you know, using these applications. So suddenly, a very high-end, very, you know, limited, you know, application with very limited user community can open up to, you know, a very large mass market, you know, user community. So, you know, this, you know, if you look at these applications, some of these applications will have, you know, what we call the fine granularity. You're going to, you know, see a lot of these applications are doing, you know, a massive number of matrix multiplication and, you know, solving matrices and so on. And on the other hand, there will be also, you know, other applications that require coarser granularity. You know, some of these applications may be doing some very sophisticated, you know, actions that need to be coordinated in parallel. And, you know, you will find that the GPUs will be executing these finer grain parallelism much better than the coarser grain. And so, you know, a lot of the coarser grain, you know, applications will also have both finer grain and coarser grain, you know, sections. And you will see some of those sections will execute better on the CPUs and some of the sections will execute better on the GPUs. So this goes, you know, leads us into slide 21. And where we talk about the sort of the lineage of GPUs and CPUs in a little bit more detail. So you know what, none of these things come out of the blue, and you know, both of them are evolution from, you know, from some, you know, large market or mass market products. So you know what, they're really two categories of processors in the market today, and the one category is what we call the you know, the parallel architectures for you know, for special applications. And these things include digital signal processing, graphics processing, network processing, and some scientific processing. And these application, you know, these processors, you know, they're you know, they're structured in a way that you know, they are targeting some, you know, a limited application domain. Therefore, you know, their processors or processor elements don't need to be you know, very powerful, and they are organized in a way that you know, they can be very effective in some applications, but they may not need to be. They don't need to be effective for some other applications. And it's well known that, for example, in the cell phone domain, you know, DSP chips have been used to provide massive, you know, parallel process, you know, processing capabilities at very low power, and they're able to achieve these, you know, very demanding goals because they only need to worry about digital signal processing. And however, as you know, chip resources increase, as we can put more and more transistors into these chips, you know, the manufacturers of these more the special purpose chips start to, you know, to think about ways to, you know, to leverage the increased hardware resources to be able to cover more applications and therefore to broaden their markets. So this is why we see CUDA that grew out of the GPU application domain, out of the graphics application domain. And so on the other hand, we also see that you know, there's a category in the that are CPUs, and these CPUs are you know, to traditionally can handle practically any application. You know, every application you throw at it, they will run, they will be able to run these applications, and reasonably well. However, as the, you know, as the performance growth of single thread, you know, design style, you know, start to stall, then you know, the CPU designers start to say, hey, you know what, for us to continue to utilize more transistors per chip, we will need to, you know, we will need to begin to provide performance through multiple processor cores. So, you know, that's why we're seeing, you know what, the CPUs that are going from 1 core to 2 cores to 4 cores to 6 cores to 8 cores and so on. And the CPU manufacturers need to be careful when they extend into the multiprocessor market. By making their processors parallel, they need to also be careful not to make their the sequential application slower. It will not be very good for them to go to their customers and say, hey, I have good news and bad news. The good news is that I'm giving you some parallel processing capability on the chip. So if you can parallelize your application, you can get a large multiple times of speed up. But I also have bad news. The application that you're selling to your customers, it just lost 40% of its performance, or it just is running 3 times slower. And this is just not the kind of message that will be accepted by the customers. So that's why the CPUs, the developers, even though they know they will need to be able to eventually provide hundreds times of speed up to their customers, but they really need to take a very slow evolution path of 2, of 4, of 8, and so on, so that before they can get there. And that slow evolution process is not purely technical. It's really limited by their current market. And this is actually documented very nicely in the book, Innovator's Dilemma. And the existing success or successful market for the companies oftentimes limit how quickly they can convert their products into the type of products that are needed for future. And the GPU kind of vendors are also going to have to go through a slow evolution process. And in the GPU case, they have to serve their graphics market, and they cannot go to their graphics customer and say, hey, I have good news and bad news. The good news is, I have broadened the application that you can run on the GPU. So you can now run all these different other applications on the GPU, and if you can manage to find them, right? But on the other hand, I have bad news for you. Your graphics application just run become 3 times slower in my new product. That's not going to be an acceptable message to the customers either. So that's why the kind of GPUs that we're going to see in the next few generations will still have a very limited number of applications that will run well. But whenever they run well on these processors, they are going to scream. So that's why you're going to need to be able to make the best out of the combination of the CPUs and GPUs through this course. So it will be in the foreseeable future, these chips are not going to be able to replace each other, and they will need to work in tandem and complement each other to get the best results. So the next slide, 22, shows some of the previous projects that students undertook in this course. We see video processing, we see computational fluid dynamics, we see encryption applications, we see finite element modeling, and we see quantum chemistry, we see network simulation, and we see some linear algebra, we see astrophysics, and we see some finite difference time domain antenna analysis, and we see medical imaging. And you should realize that this course is not dedicated to any particular application domain. You should feel free to propose applications that are of importance to you. And if you look at the source code level, column, most of the source code are in the hundreds or in the low thousands of lines of code, except for one. And so you know, when you pick your applications, you need to also be more realistic about, you know, how large an application you can handle, and make sure that you don't pick an application that has a few million lines of code, and chances are you won't be able to finish your project by the end of the semester. And the kernel column shows the actual function or functions that the students were able to actually get out of the original code, and these are the number of lines in the original code that correspond to those functions. And those functions are parallelized and tuned and so on to run with high performance on the GPU, and the rest of the code will be running on the CPU. And the percentage time shows that the percentage of execution time on the original in the original source code the original source code of these kernels accounted for in the execution. So naturally we're going to be talking about MDoS law and so on, that you really need to make sure that the code that you parallelize account for a very large percentage of the execution time, so that by doing parallel execution on the code, you can result in very significant speed up in your overall application. So slide 23 shows that for these applications, the students were able to get a fairly large amount of speed up for the kernels and as well as for the real entire applications. And getting about 10 times speed up is quite common. And getting 10 times speed up in an application can be very significant. You may have an application where it's running in the lab, but it takes something like a day to execute, so it's just not practical for people to use. On the other hand, if you speed it up by 10 times, you might be able to get it into a practical use. It becomes 2 hours rather than a whole day. And you can also have a situation where if an application used to take an hour, now it takes a few minutes, then you can start to have very interactive use of these applications. So those are good. But whenever you have about 100 times speed up as some of these applications enjoyed, then you can start to actually very innovative and creative of the applications. And for example, you may have a scientific simulation program that used to use FFT to approximate what you really want to solve. And so by being able to get a 100 times speed up, you might be able to start to use convolution-based approach or linear solver-based approach to rather than FFT. And then you can eliminate some of the approximations in your simulation, so that you can be much, much more accurate. So once you get into these very large amount of speed up, then you can start to be to fundamentally improve the quality of the work, rather than necessarily just make things faster. So in a lot of the applications, being able to get better quality results and then is much more important than being able to run the application fast. So this semester, we recognize the need for more of our students and then more engineers in the industry to understand where the increased speed, what increased speed can mean to important application domains. So that's why Sanjay Patel and I are organizing a Need for Speed seminar series. And it's going to be on Wednesdays and 4 o'clock. And we're going to have the flyers out this week. And we're going to kick off next week with a keynote lecture by David Kirk to kick off the whole lecture series And so you know what, you should really try to attend as many of these seminars as possible. And these seminars also are going to be recorded and available on the web the various websites, and so that you are going to learn why some of these things will require further increased speed. And so this leads to a nice quote that I saw recently. Basically the quote says, those who know how will always have a job. Those who know how to solve problems, how to design products, how to run political campaigns and so on, they will always have a job. But those who know why will always be their boss. So this course is, much of the course content is going to teach you how to program, how to get performance, how to get programs to run faster. However, you should spend time to go to these Need for Speed kind of seminar series to make sure that you also know why you're looking this, so that you don't end up being you don't always wonder why you can never become a boss in the future. So this concludes the first lecture, and I will see all of you on Wednesday, Thursday at 9:30. Thank you for coming.